Let me encourage you to open up your Bibles or your Bible apps as you follow along during the sermon. But for now, you can also follow along on the slides as well. Ezra chapter 6 from verse 1. King Darius then issued an order, and they searched in the archives stored in the treasury at Babylon. A scroll was found in the citadel of Ecbatana in the province of Media, and this was written on it. Memorandum. In the first year of King Cyrus, the king issued a decree concerning the temple of God in Jerusalem. Let the temple be rebuilt as a place to present sacrifices, and let its foundations be laid. It is to be 60 cubits high and 60 cubits wide, with three courses of large stones and one of timbers. The costs are to be paid by the royal treasury. Also, the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, are to be returned to their places in the temple in Jerusalem. They are to be deposited in the house of God. Now then, Tattenai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai, and you other officials of that province, stay away from there. Do not interfere with the work on this temple of God. Let the governor of the Jews and the Jewish elders rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I hereby decree what you are to do for these elders of the Jews in the construction of this house of God. Their expenses are to be fully paid out of the royal treasury from the revenues of Trans-Euphrates, so that the work will not stop. Whatever is needed, young bulls, rams, male lambs for burnt offerings to the God of heaven, and wheat, salt, wine, and olive oil, as requested by the priests in Jerusalem, must be given them daily without fail, so that they may offer sacrifices pleasing to the God of heaven and pray for the well-being of the king and his sons. Furthermore, I decree that if anyone defiles this edict, they are to be pulled from their house and they are to be impaled on it. And for this crime, their house is to be made a pile of rubble. May God, who has caused his name to dwell there, overthrow any king or people who lifts a hand to change this decree or to destroy this temple in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have decreed it. Let it be carried out with diligence. Then, because of the decree King Darius had sent, Tattenai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai and their associates carried it out with diligence. So the elders of the Jews continued to build and prosper under the preaching of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah, a descendant of Iddo. They finished building the temple according to the command of the God of Israel and the decrees of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, kings of Persia. The temple was completed on the third day of the month Adar, in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. Then the people of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles celebrated the dedication of the house of God with joy. For the dedication of this house of God, they offered 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 male lambs, and, as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats, one for each of the tribes of Israel. And they installed the priests in their divisions and the Levites in their groups for the service of God at Jerusalem, according to what is written in the book of Moses. On the 14th day of the first month, the exiles celebrated the Passover. The priests and Levites had purified themselves and were all ceremonially clean. The Levites slaughtered the Passover lamb for all the exiles, for their relatives, the priests, and for themselves. So the Israelites who had returned from the exile ate it, together with all who had separated themselves from the unclean practices of their Gentile neighbors in order to seek the Lord, the God of Israel. For 7 days they celebrated with joy the festival of unleavened bread, because the Lord had filled them with joy by changing the attitude of the king of Assyria, so that he assisted them in the work on the house of God, the God of Israel. Reverend Ying's now going to speak from this passage.
Thanks, Ed. And a good evening to the evening service. It's good to have you here. And if you're new here for the very first time, a special welcome. My name's Ying, and I'm one of the English pastors along with Dan and Winston. Hopefully you'll get to meet them over time. Well, today is a special day. As you know, it's Anzac Day. But I think a lot of people are pretty cheesed off that Anzac Day occurs on a Saturday and the government decided not to give a public holiday on a Monday, right? But let's imagine just for a moment that the government did a sort of change that and decided to declare a public holiday tomorrow. What would you do? What would you do? If you could do anything, what would you do if it was a public holiday tomorrow? Turn to the person next to you, you have 15 seconds, because I don't think you need a lot of time to think of it. 15 seconds, what would you want to do? All right? What would you do? What would you do? All right, that's enough. I think you sort of, yeah, I think you already know what you want to do. So let's give a shot. What would you want to do? Who wants to throw the, who wants to be first man off? First one, what would you want to do?
Sleep in.
Sleep. Oh, come on. Sleep in. You got to do better than that. Sleep in. What else? Now, I'm going to put some sunnies on, not because I'm cool, because I didn't bring my long other glasses, okay? So, I didn't bring my glasses, so, you know, I got cataract and I got, maybe I should get contacts. I don't know. Anyway, so it's not because I'm trying to be cool. Does a bit strange. Just get over it, all right? All right. I hope this is not being videoed. It is, actually. All right, what would you want to do? All right, sleep in. Come on. Ah, Becca, top that. No photography in this room. No, they were the reading glasses. All right, what would you want to do? I'm going to take them off. Carolyn. All right, what would you want to do? All right, come on. Christine. All right, what else? Let's put aside sleeping. I think you guys are young enough. Yeah, Carolyn. Right, okay. All right, that's exciting. I'll watch it with you, okay? In my dreams, anyway. Anyone else? Pip. Don't say sleep in. What was that?
Nothing.
Okay. I can see this is a very excitable group. Well, I was driving into church this morning and looking at Anzac, I thought to myself, I saw all these people. What were they doing? People were bike riding, people were running, people were walking. But it's a holiday. Well, you know, sort of a holiday, right? And for most people, Anzac is nothing more than just a public holiday. But for few people, it's much more than that, isn't it? It's actually a celebration of freedom, a celebration of freedom. A freedom that has been won for us many years ago with the Anzacs, with the Second World War. And Anzac Day is also a celebration of freedom that's fought for us by many other sorts of armed forces over the many years. But it's not just a celebration time, is it? It's also a reminder. It's a reminder that freedom is something that comes at a great cost. Lives were lost in that attempt and that venture to actually protect our freedom. Freedom comes at a great cost. There are many people who constantly oppose freedom. That's what, and it's something that we are tempted to forget over and over again, which is why we often say at Anzac Day, lest we forget. The nature of we are by nature forgetful people. And one big idea that I want to bring out today is that we also run the danger of forgetting that God's great purposes and plans always march forward, unstoppable, but always in the midst of great opposition and great hostility. We need to understand that. That God's purposes and plans for his people and for the world, unstoppable as it is, always marches forward in the face of great opposition and great hostility. That is what we want to look at today as we look at Ezra chapter 4 to 6. But to give you a bit of background or remind ourselves where we are looking at a nation, Israel, a once great nation in the time of Solomon. It was at the height of its glory, the height of its influence, the height of its power, but it was now nothing more than a nation that had been decimated, its city destroyed, its people in exile. And the last nail in the coffin, you could say, was the destruction of their beloved temple. The temple for them was not just a building. It was an icon. It was a symbol of their own greatness. Why is that? Because the temple was the very symbol of the representation of God's presence amongst the people. the God of heaven and earth dwelt amongst the people of Israel, and that was symbolized or represented in the temple. The temple was described as the very house of God. From the temple, God's glory would be manifested. From that temple, God would rule not only Israel, but rule the world. And to the temple is where people need to go to meet God. To the temple is where people need to go to actually bring their petitions to God. So it's interesting also that in the book of Daniel, when Daniel decides to pray, he's in exile, what does he do? He faces the direction of the temple. Because the promise is, if you pray to the temple where God dwells, then he will hear from the temple and answer the prayers of all his people. But the problem is, as I said, the people are in exile, the city is in ruins, the land is barren, and the temple is no longer. It was a state of absolute hopelessness. But the promise is given that one day God would rebuild his temple, glorify his name, establish his rule not only in Israel again, but to the whole world, and bring his people back. Now that seems like that's a great promise, but it's almost seemingly impossible promise, because the people of Israel were in exile. They were nobody people, no army, no power, nothing. And yet the promise is given that God will bring them back. And people at the time would say, well, look, Jeremiah, get a reality check. Just look at who we are. Look at the power around us. Are you saying that one day things are going to be restored back? Get a reality check. But when you come to the book of Ezra, how does it begin? It begins with these great words in Ezra chapter 1, that according to the promise that's given by Jeremiah, the promise given by Jeremiah, God moves the hearts and minds of the king of Persia to open the gate for them to go back and to rebuild the temple. The promise that was given many decades beforehand is now seemingly unexpectedly being fulfilled as promised. And anyone who would have been there at the time would have seen this is fantastic. The door, the impossible is now possible. The door that was so barred shut has now been opened. And people would have been rapturous with great joy to see that things are finally turning around. But the important thing we always need to remember, as I said earlier, that God's plans and purposes to bring to bring about the restoration of his temple, to glorify his name, to establish rule and bring his people back, always meets stiff opposition. You see, there's an important principle that the scriptures teaches us. God will not always take or calm the storms around us, but he will actually take us through the storm safe and sound to the other end. He does not always take away the darkness that surrounds us, but rather what he does is gives us a torch to guide us through that darkness so that we won't stumble. He doesn't necessarily remove the hostility, but what he does is he strengthens us to face that hostility. And he doesn't necessarily remove the wars that surround his people, but what he does, he gives us peace in the midst of that war. When we read the book of Ezra, God's promises and purposes and plans are now being moving forward and slowly being fulfilled. And everyone would think this is fantastic. But as you come to chapters 4 to 6, what you begin to see is a mounting, a rising opposition to the work of God. Rising opposition and hostility. Well, let's have a look at that in chapter 4. They begin their work in earnest under the permission and the provision of the king of Persia. But as soon as they begin the work, the opposition starts. Have a look at chapter 4, verse 4. We see these words. Then the people around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. Firstly, they faced great discouragement. Now, you know what it's like to be discouraged, don't you? You start something new and someone says, oh, that's not going to work. You try and venture out and say, you crazy? Look at you. You don't have the skill for that sort of thing. It's too hard. You're not going to be able to do it. That's discouragement, isn't it? And a lot of times when we try to do something, there are people who will discourage us. They might be well-meaning, trying to help us to be more realistic, but they nevertheless, the words they say discourage us. These people were being certainly discouraged in what they were trying to do. But the discouragement that they received was on a much higher level, because what do we read? Then the people around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. In other words, they were being threatened. It borders on being bullied into passivity. You know what it's like? Well, maybe you don't, but you've heard of people who've been discouraged or being bullied from doing anything, whether it be workplace, office politics, whether it's school, at university, whatever the case is. We know of situations, we've heard of people who are being bullied from doing anything, feeling very terrified to go to school, terrified to go to work, terrified to do anything because of the threats of what other people might do to them. And this was the case here, that as they set about to do the work of God, to rebuild his temple, there were threats on their life and they were terrified, absolutely terrified. But it didn't just stop there, because they began to escalate their complaints to higher authorities. And so what do we read here in verse 5? They bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. That is to say, it was not enough just to bully them. These thugs, you could say, now took it to officials. And notice what it says, they bribed officials. They recognized they're not going to get much leverage unless they actually started to try and persuade, or if not, put money under the counter to convince the officials to stop this work. And stop the work they did. Because we read there, they stopped it during the reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now, research tells us that was in the order of about 16 years. The work was delayed for 16 years. Overall, when they finally got back to work, it was another 4 years. So the work from beginning end was overall about 20 years. But 16 of those years was delayed. Now, when you think about it, 20 years overall, that seems like a long time. But I thought, let's do a comparison of how that stacks up with other great building projects, right? So look at here we have the Colosseum. It took 10 years to build that. 10 years. Well, that's pretty quick. Okay, let's do a quick quiz. Leaning Tower of Pizza. How long did that take? Leaning Power Tower. How long did that take? Huh? Well, Leaning Tower of Pizza? Oh, well, Pizza. I've never been there. All right, Pizza. Oh, the Leaning Tower, okay? How long did it take? All right, let's. Any architects here? Oh, yeah. Sam, how long? Five years, okay. Yeah, that's okay. That's close. All right, anyone else? I'm going to put my sunnies on. it substitutes a brown paper bag over my head so I don't get nervous. Anyone else? Hans, you're the sort of creative man. 7 years. Anyone double up that one? 14? Anyone go higher?
Yeah, 17 years.
Okay, I'm going one. Huh? Oh, 70 years. Okay, going once, going twice. Anyone increase lower? One, someone in the back there? One more? Joyce? 5 years, okay. Whoa! What did you say? That's crazy, isn't it? Whoa, 199 years, man, that's crazy, isn't it? All right, let's try this one. St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. All right, now this is the easier one, all right? Sam, let's go back to you. You're the architect. Okay, Christine, you can help him. 100 years? All right, anyone else?
1 year.
1 year, Andy, 1 year, right. Maybe you should stick to your daytime job. Esther. 230, yeah, all right. 200, that's very precise, okay. 144 years. Oh, okay. Hey, let's do one more. Okay, let's one more, okay? Three's a good trip. Oh, well, we know this one, okay? We know this one, all right. Joe. 70 years. Okay, one more. Let's give it a shot. Let's get one of our elders. Edwin. 150. Oh, wow. 21 years. And then you got Buckingham Palace. How long did Buckingham Palace? 23 years. White House, 13 years, right? Now, when you think about it, the building of the temple overall is 20 years. It didn't take a long time by the scale of things, right? But really, what it seemed like eternity, because what was the problem? It was really that the whole empire was against them. It seemed like an absolute impossible task. And a task that was so impossible because of the empire. And you notice what it said also, that they were so determined to make sure that this building project never got off the ground, that they even wrote letters to the king to ensure that this would never happen. And we're very blessed, if you read chapter 5, which we'll have on the screen, that we have a copy of the letter which their opponents actually sent to the king, telling them why that king should not let this happen. Have a look at the letter which you read in chapter 4. This is a copy of the letter they sent to King Artaxerxes. It's quite incredible when you think about it. It's such an ancient letter, and we have here an ancient official communique. To King Artaxerxes, from your servants in Trans-Euphrates, right? The king should know that the people who came up to us from you have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if the city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes, tribute, or duty will be paid, and eventually the royal revenue will suffer. Now, since we are under obligation to the palace and it's not proper for us to see the king dishonored, we are sending this message to inform the king so that search may be made in the archives of your predecessors. In these records, you'll find that this city is a rebellious city, troublesome to the kings and provinces, a place with a long history of sedition. This is why this city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls are restored, you will be left with nothing in Trans-Euphrates. And you get the sense of what they're trying to say, the accusation they make against the people of God. They are a rebellious and wicked city. That's pretty heavy, isn't it? And not only that, just to really seal the deal, what do they say? If you let these guys continue on, what will they do? They will essentially bankrupt the nation, the empire. They won't pay their taxes, they won't pay their duties, they won't pay their tributes and so on like that. You will be left with nothing. Now, when you hear a letter like that, what do? Well, not surprisingly, what does the king do? He puts an order out to stop the rebuilding of this this temple. And therefore, it's stopped for the next 16 years. Now, pause and reflect for a moment what we see here in chapters 4 to 6. We see a pattern that continues to recur again and again and again. There is constant discouragement. There's constant threat on people's lives. And in the end, it escalates to official bans on what God's people want to do. And we see this throughout history, don't we? Where people are being bullied, threatened. And worse comes to worse, where you have countries where Christianity is officially banned. You have countries where if you want to try and share the gospel, you are in prison. And in some cases, where you try to share the gospel, there is a death penalty. I met a Muslim from Iran in Malaysia. When he became a Christian, he literally had to flee for his life and has never been able to go to Iran or even see his parents, because if he did, one, he'd be arrested and executed, and if not, by his own parents. And we see this again and again and again. And even in recent times in Australia, Christianity was once sort of like a cool, okay type of religion. Over time, it became much more neutral. That is, okay, you believe your thing, I believe my thing, and let's agree to disagree. But more recently, with the plebiscite, we are beginning to see a tide changing, so that Christianity is now not so much your thing, my thing, let's keep it separate and agree to disagree. Now Christianity is seen as a dangerous thing to be done away with. And as we saw with the whole plebiscite, big movement to try, and even now with schools, to ban Christianity from the schools. Discouragement threats legal opposition. What we also read, however, despite that, when you read in chapter 5, under the teaching of Haggai and Zechariah, which you can also see in the Old Testament, the people were galvanized to recommence the work and to get back to rebuilding the temple of God. But when you come to read chapter 5 and they give themselves back to rebuilding the temple of God, guess what happened? People challenge them, say, who told you you can actually rebuild this temple? And they give their response, and their response is they're recorded in the scriptures, and again, that is sent to the king at the time. And we have that letter again. Listen to what it says in this particular letter. This is subsequent. So one king has passed. Now we have another king. And so the opposition has continued on, not just for a season, but for decades, literally. This is a copy of the letter that Tatanai, governor of Euphrates, and Shethabozani, Ed says it really well, right? And their associates, the officials, the Trans-Euphrates, sent to King Darius. The report they sent him read as follows. This is the letter now to the new king. To King Darius, cordial greetings. The king should know that we went to the district of Judah, to the temple of the great God. The people are building it with large stones and placing the timbers in the walls. The work is being carried on with diligence and is making rapid progress under their direction. We questioned the elders and asked them, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and to finish it? You get the sort of sense of, okay, who allowed you to do this? Intimidation. We also asked them their names so that we could write down the names of their leaders for your information. And presumably the idea is for prosecution, so that the leaders who start this venture, and if it's found illegal, will then be prosecuted, if not in prison, if not executed or whatever. This is the answer they gave us. So when they ask who told you can do this, this is their answer. And now he communicates that to the king. We are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, one that a great king of Israel built and finished. But because our ancestors angered the God of heaven, he gave them into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, the Chaldean king of Babylon, who destroyed this temple and deported the people to Babylon. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to rebuild this house of God. He even removed from the temple of Babylon the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to the temple in Babylon. Then King Cyrus, the subsequent king, gave them to a man named Sheshbazzar, whom he had appointed governor. And he told him, take these articles, go and deposit them in the temple in Jerusalem, and rebuild the house of God on its site. You see what they're saying? We have official mandate from the king, from King Cyrus himself, who has allowed us and provided for us to rebuild this. So this Sheshbazzar came and laid this the foundation of the house of God in Jerusalem. From that day to the present, it has been under construction, but is not yet finished. Now if it pleases the king, let a search be made in the royal archives of Babylon, see if King Cyrus did in fact issue a decree to rebuild this house of God in Jerusalem. Then let the king send us his decision in this matter. So what's he essentially saying? We're doing what we've been allowed to do many years ago by the great King Cyrus. We're just doing what he allowed and he provided for. And if you don't believe us, go and just check out the archives. They check out the archives. And what do we read? Well, we read in chapter 6. They checked out the archives and they and the king actually confirmed, yes, that's what they're doing is legit. And therefore, let's support that work because it was legalized. Let's support the work. Let's provide for their provision. And in fact, if anyone stops what they're doing, let them be impaled. That is the story of chapters 4 to 6. But what is interesting is how in the face of discouragement and threats and of legal opposition, how does that section end? It ends in the way it began. How did section chapters 1 to 6 begin? Well, have a look at that. In Ezra chapter 1 verse 1, remember, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord, not the way, moved the heart of King Cyrus of Persia to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put in writing. That's how that section begins. But notice how it ends. For 7 days they celebrate with joy the festival of unleavened bread because the Lord had filled them with joy. How? By changing the attitude of the king of Syria so that he assisted them in the work on the house of God, the God of Israel. And what's it actually saying here? That even despite discouragement, despite threats to their life, and despite legal opposition, opposition came from the whole empire. God moved the heart of kings. He moved mountains to make it possible so that the work of God, his purposes and plans to glorify his name, to rebuild his temple and to bring his people back have now been made possible. Because the big point of the Old Testament, in particular Ezra, is that God's work is always, always unstoppable. But that being said, the point of chapters 4 to 6 also reminds us once again that even though his work is unstoppable, it doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean it's pain-free. His work marches on in the face of opposition and rising hostility. And we need to understand that. You remember we began this year by talking about the Great Commission. And Jesus said that all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, therefore go and make disciples of all nations. And we think to ourselves, all authority has been given to me. And the implication and the perception for many of us, well, it should be easy. But not so. Listen to these words of what Jesus gave to his disciples. I am sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore be as shrewd as snake and as innocent doves. Be on your guard. You'll be handed over to the local councils and be flogged in the synagogues. On my account, you'll be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. But when they arrest you, do not worry about what to say or how to say it. At that time, you will be given what to say, for it will not be you speaking, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. And what's it actually saying there? That Jesus will always be with his disciples. That Jesus has all authority in heaven and earth and therefore equip and empower his people wherever they go to make disciples. But that doesn't mean it will be easy. God's plans and his purposes always marches forward in the face of opposition and hostility. He doesn't always calm the storms around us, but he will actually guide us safely through that storm. He doesn't always take away the night around us, but will give us a torch to guide us through the night so that we will not stumble. And we see this also being played out in the life of Paul. There's an interesting passage in 1 Corinthians where he talks about an opportunity. Notice what he says. I will stay on at Ephesus until Pentecost. And note what he says here. Because a great door for effective work is open to me. And you read that and say, fantastic. People want to hear the gospel. People are going to get converted. Fantastic. And we think to ourselves, that's what I want to be. I want to be there because I'm going to see excitement. I'm going to see joy. I'm going to see people just point up their hands and say, I want to be a Christian. But notice what Paul says. And there are many who oppose me. See that? Opportunity doesn't mean there are no opponents. Opportunity for spreading the work of God often increases the opposition. And we see that in the book of Ezra. We see it through the whole Bible, and we see it even in our own personal experience. It's interesting in Paul, 2 Timothy chapter 4, in his closing address to his young disciple. At my first offense, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me. May it not be held against them. But the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. And I was delivered from the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil attack and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. To him be glory forever and ever. And notice what Paul says there. His confidence is the fact that God will rescue him. And what does it mean that God will rescue him? Does it mean God will free him from prison? That God will spare his life? That God will help him find final rest in a nice island sort of getaway? Not so. Because we know that he will go on to be persecuted and martyred for the faith. So what does it mean to be rescued? And the answer is given in that last part of that sentence. Who will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. What's he actually saying here? That God is the one who will equip me, empower me, so I will not succumb to temptation. He is the one who will strengthen me so I will not give in. He is the one who will empower me so that with great courage and joy and clarity and loudness, I will proclaim the gospel and I will run this race to the very end and not falter. See, God's work, his purposes and plans will march forward. But it does not mean there will not be any opposition. If anything, it always comes in the face of opposition. What does it mean for us? Well, I think Paul's final words to Timothy also are fairly worth noting. As Paul reflects on his own life and on the spread of the gospel, this is what Paul calls upon Timothy. And I think it's salutary for us to think about its challenge to us. For this reason, I remind you to fan and flame the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For the Spirit of God does not make us timid, but gives us power, love, and self-discipline. So do not be ashamed of the testimony about our Lord or of me, his prisoner, but rather join with me in suffering for the gospel by the power of God. What does he call upon them to do? Timothy to do? Join with me in suffering for the gospel. You see, at the end of the day, if you truly understand God's promises, his power, and his plan, then it should give us great confidence. Great confidence. In the midst of discouragement and threats and national opposition, God's purposes still are achieved. And that should give us great confidence. But what should therefore challenge us to do? To be committed to that work. Because if that's what God's doing, well, why aren't we getting on with the program? If that's what God is planning to do, why aren't we doing this sort of thing? If all authority has been given to Jesus for us to make disciples, then why aren't we doing that? Get with the program. But let us also recognize that there will always be opposition. And therefore, there's always a great need for courage. Courage doesn't is not fearlessness. Courage is fighting against the fear to move forward in our commitment to see God's purposes and plans fulfilled in this world. You know, today is Anzac Day. It's a reminder that freedom does not come easily. It's a reminder that there will always be those who oppose freedom. Lest we forget is why we need to celebrate Anzac. But in the same way we are not to forget what Anzac stands for, then Ezra reminds us never ever forget that God's promises and plans will be achieved without doubt, but they will always be achieved in the face of opposition and hostility. So he calls us upon us to be confident, to be committed to that task, and to move forward with great courage. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we give you thanks for your promises and your plans to make your name great, to rule this world, to bring people to yourself. And we are thankful and stand in awe because that is a work that you are doing. And nothing in history has stopped that work. And nothing in heaven and earth will ever stop that work. We pray for ourselves if that's your work, help us to be committed to that work. But we pray for great courage in the face to apply ourselves to that work because we know that as your work moves forward, there will always be opposition and hostility. But Lord, help us to do so with great confidence as well, because you are sovereign, you are powerful, and your purposes and plans will always be fulfilled.